Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the one and only and very talented Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
We've got a big show tonight. I want to make sure people tune in for it. We have our live Darkness Radio Presents Holzer's Ghosts. And tonight we're talking Lambert Castle. This was an amazing episode that had a lot of weird twists and turns, from ghostly sightings to possible reincarnation. We have Damien Bertrand, the hypnotist, who's a well-known and famed what do they call hypno-regressionists. We're going to have him on the show to talk. We've got psychic April, who was a part of the episode as well, Barbara David. So we've got a great panel discussion this evening regarding that episode. It is season one, I think, episode six from the Holzer Files. So we're going to talk about that tonight live stream. You can find it on the Darkness Radio YouTube channel. Go subscribe. It's free. Then hit the little bell so you never miss another special episode, and you'll see all of our first run content on that site as well. For those of you listening through podcast means, of course, the audio portion will be made available tomorrow right here, so you can tune in and check that out. All right, let's get to it. This is the biggest thing I would say, Tim, dealing with the paranormal since we started the show.
Mm-hmm.
15, 16 years ago, back in the late 1800s, people always ask, Dave, you know, has your thinking turned around on many of the subjects where it comes to ghosts and UFOs, Bigfoot? And I would say yes. I am entertaining a concept now much more, and we've been talking about this for a few years, regarding what these moments might really mean. Are we really seeing a physical being that is here and just able to hide, being aliens or Bigfoot? Are we really seeing the ghost of grandma, or is something else at play? And the time slip phenomena has really become a bigger part of the concepts that I'm believing and understanding more. And there are so many fascinating stories regarding this that I would say, Tim, that falls more into the category of where my belief systems are turning now. Not saying that there aren't some intelligent hauntings and strange phenomena that takes place, but I'm starting to think a lot more has to do with time slips. I mean, you've talked about this, on and off air and at conventions. What are your thoughts on this? Is this something that you're giving more credence and believability to?
Well, I find it fascinating. I do still tend to dwell in the realm of intelligent hauntings, though, and I do believe we still are making contact with the other side. I know at this point you're going to say, okay, good night, everybody. But I do find time slips fascinating. I can't say, though, that I've ever had that experience. With that said, I do find it fascinating.
Right. I've talked about a weird one I had. Granted, it involved marijuana. So you've got to question those moments. But the fact that there were other people there that were corroborating the very high strangeness of the situation, mm-hmm. and I don't mean that as a pun when I say high strangeness, but for those of you that don't recall, I was in a movie theater, a buddy of mine, when the movie 28 Days came out, or 28 Days Later, not the Sandra Bullock movie, but the zombie movie, 28 Days Later. We might have partaken in a little bit of the devil's lettuce, Tim. And as I sat in the theater waiting for the movie to begin, chatting with my friend Leo, I kept slipping in and out of what I would say. And these were almost like parallel universes as opposed to time slips. But right. It has a time slip element to it, because there was a couple behind us. And when I would pop into this alternate reality, they were crying about their dog having gone missing. And then I'd shift back into this reality, and they were just talking about, I don't know, what they were going to do that night. And I finally, Leo, my buddy, realized something was going on with me. He's questioning me about it. And I told him I'm popping back and forth between realities. And he kind of laughed and he's like, man, this is some good stuff. And I said, no, this is weird, because the couple behind us is the same couple, but they're talking about their dog having gone missing and she's crying. And all of a sudden the guy behind me leans forward and he goes, what did you just say? And I repeated it, and the two of them looked at each other and he goes, are you screwing with us right now? And I'm like, no, why? And he goes, we were here a week ago sitting in these same seats watching a movie, and before the movie we were talking because our dog went missing and she was crying the entire time. So it was this very weird, what happened to me moment. Was it the drugs? Was this all hallucinatory? However, Leo remembered it, and we talked about it for days after it took place. So it wasn't just me encapsulating this strange little hallucinatory moment. The people behind me and Leo were all witness to what was going on. So it was a very strange situation. What was happening in that moment? I still don't have a firm grasp of. But there's a new book that just hit April 6th. It is called Time Shifts, Experiences of Slipping into the Past and Future. Von Brashler, one of our favorite guests, back with us again today to discuss this new book, this new paradigm of thinking. Welcome back to the show, Von. Good to have you here, sir.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Tim. Good to be with you. Love Darkness Radio. And hey, congrats on the Holzer Files.
Thank you.
Killer show.
Thank you. Yeah, we've been having a good time with that. I appreciate it. Listen, I love the concept. I love the book. Matter of fact, if you go check, folks, we have a link for the book in today's program guide. Go order it. Get yourself a copy. It's available on Kindle and paperback. But I was one of the reviewers for this book when it first was going to be released. I love the concept that there's so much more going on with what we're dealing with in the world of what we kind of call the supernatural now, and these different concepts of how they may come into play. Talk to me a little bit about how this concept came to you, why you decided that there was enough intel about it to really kind of put pen to paper and write a book.
Well, two things. I agree with you. I think that a lot of the things that pop in and out of what we call ordinary reality or non-ordinary reality, most likely, would be time shifts. And often we just slip accidentally into it. There's that, you know, and Lord knows I've written two about ghosts, and you've had me on talking about ghosts. And I think some of these and some of these alien encounters could very well be, in some instances, not all, could be time shifts, could be time travel. And I also, having written about time before, would encounter a lot of people that would want to talk about their personal time slips. And it seems to happen more often to more people than we think, and some people just dismiss it. So I think a lot of people, like you, Dave, have experienced some kind of a time slip.
Well, kind of hearing what I described, obviously you've got to take into effect, I had smoked some marijuana, so there's a mind-altering substance. Now there's the question of, does that open the pineal gland, allowing the third eye to come awake and be more aware of different elements of reality? Or, you know, could it have just been a really good hallucination because my buddy was so high, he was kind of following along on my little trip? Hearing this concept, though, that they were there a week before in the exact same seats talking about their dog having gone missing, and then here we are a week later watching a film, and they're connecting to it. I don't know if they were toying with me or what, but she looked genuinely upset by my conversation. The guy, just mouth agape and eyes huge like saucers, couldn't believe what I was saying, or so he said at the time. But what are your thoughts of you know, my relating that story?
Well, I think you nailed it. It's altered consciousness. That's what it is. I mean, I'm basically a journalist. That's the way I started out, and that's the way I approach everything. So I write about my own experiences as honestly as I can. I interview people, and I relate stories that I've heard that are like secondhand stories, interviews. And then I look at what I thought were credible accounts that are classic stories of time shifts and time slips. And I look for collaboration, as you had in the theater, collaboration. I look for someone who is credible. You know, are the reports of this? You know, has it been studied? You know, and I look for arguments for or against time shifts. And the one thing that always came up, seemed to always come up, was an altered state of consciousness. And that includes people who are really good at shifting in time.
You're saying people that are really good at shifting in time are, is this something you can learn to do for yourself to pop back and forth? And is it safe?
Yeah. So what I do in the book is try to set up some exercises. Now, these are just not crazy things that I thought up. You know, it's like, as I say, I'm a journalist. So I look at credible sources that have a time-honored tradition of doing this. So I looked at, in the yoga tradition, primarily I looked at Samadhi mystics who slip in and out of what we call ordinary time and space. I looked at the shamanic tradition, globally, but primarily in North America, the Native Americans, the first Americans. And we see dream walkers, spirit walkers, skin walkers. They go into very similar to a yoga trance. They go into a deep trance, and they seem to go back or forward in time and experience a different time and space. And so what they'll do is they'll go back as a witness into the past to listen to the ancestors. You know, there's very little interaction as a rule when you do these time shifts. Mostly you're just there, you know, like an etheric body there. And then they would go forward in time to see what lies ahead for their people and the land. And they report back what they've seen, you know, for insight and direction as to, you know, what the ancestors say and what lies ahead. So these exercises I have, to cut to the chase, are based mainly on things that I've taken from the sutras or exercises in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. The Yoga Sutras is a classic yoga book. But the first part is like introduction to yoga, okay? You know, learning your postures, you know, getting in the right frame of mind. What is yoga? Union with the divine, you know? And then the middle of the book is mysticism. And the last third of the book is all on magic. So these are exercises largely taken from yoga's classic book, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is kind of lost in ancient language, and I've tried to kind of simplify it to make it doable, you know, with little exercises that people can try.
And I'd like to tackle a little bit of that here in a bit, but, you know, the whole concept of time travel and what these shamanic rituals can do and what they've seen, I mean, is that more of a form of remote viewing that they're doing? And is remote viewing truly a form of time travel?
Thank you. Yes. Yes and yes. You see, what happens in remote viewing, or let's say just basic astral projection, astral travel, is that you're going there in a consciousness body. So this is very much like what we're talking about. There are some differences. People always say, oh, you're talking about astral projection. Well, yes and no. You know, if you're going there in an astral body, now, mind you, I'm leaning on the yoga tradition in the Patanjali. So if you go in an astral body, you're going to go with the consciousness of your emotional body, you see. So that's fine. You can be a fly on the wall and remotely view. Yes, and you can also do this in many other ways. I have practical ideas about finding lost people, finding lost pets, finding lost keys, attracting things to you. You know, you can project your consciousness. So if you're just there looking, but how much of you do you want to travel? You know, if you're really going to take a big trip, you pack for the journey, right? This is a big trip. So you take, you know, from a yoga tradition, you take more of your emotional or subtle energy bodies with you than simply your emotional or astral body. You take your mental body. You take your causal body. You see, these connect you to various planes of reality. You take your higher spiritual bodies with you. And so it's more than just your etheric astral double that's there. But yes, to answer your question, I think remote viewing is simply projecting your consciousness. And this is very much like what we're talking about here. It's just sending more of yourself out there into the past or into the future.
It's a bigger concept, I think, than a lot of people are going to be comfortable with it at first, right? This paradigm that maybe there's, you know, things aren't as cut and dry. There aren't just beings that walk amongst us that are unseen. There's not just ghosts of disincarnate, you know, spirits wandering the earth, but that we're actually dealing with undulating, twisting time, and just certain points where it seems to come into contact with one another. There's some interesting aspects of even EVP and which is electronic voice phenomena for newer listeners, where a lot of times you'll hear a crackle, sometimes even a pop. And you remember Tim, Mark, and Debbie used to talk about that as though it was almost like a wormhole opening or something, you know, like a something, some energetic exchange for this voice to come through. And it does make you wonder exactly what are we communicating with? And is this a one consciousness? Is it a multiverse consciousness? You know, how do we start to separate where these different derivations of supernatural phenomena might actually be coming from, as opposed to it just, you know, taking it at face value?
I'm leaning toward the multiverse concept because I think there are multiple realities that are right here, right now, you know, and we've seen this so many times. People will pop in and pop out. And so, I mean, I interviewed people and I have my own stories of just, you know, was it a ghost or did we connect? You know, was there a portal, some kind of a portal? Did I have a shift in consciousness just as I entered the portal? And I actually watched, you know, pioneers crossing in their covered wagons. You know, did my mother actually see her brother 20 years before he died, and then 20 years later saw the same thing? It's like, that's weird. So I think with like ghost stories, no, I'm not saying that there are no such thing as disincarnate, disembodied beings that are like deceased people. I know that there are. I know that there are. But I think a lot of times we're actually witnessing, and this is often said by ghost chasers, ghost hunters, is that you'll see a ritualistic pattern. You know, like it's almost like on a sound. It's almost on like a loop. You're seeing the same thing over and over and over and over. And we think, well, you know, it's like they're stuck in a groove, you know. Yes, they're stuck in a groove. And what the groove they're stuck in is time, you see. They haven't moved on. And sometimes we're all on the same time loop. Let's correct that right away. The time is not linear. It doesn't start, have a midpoint, and end. We're all in the same loop. And sometimes it comes around, and with the portal, the energy portals in the earth, you can sometimes converge. So I've witnessed like Native Americans in ceremonies popping in and popping out, and they were conscious of the fact that we're popping into, you know, in on me, and I was conscious that I was popping in on them. It's just that our point on the timeline, it sometimes will converge.
And it's just in those crossings that this phenomena is even more noticeable?
Yes, it's noticeable at those times. There are certain things that seem to bring it on. What I noticed in the interviews, in the research I did, my own experience, is that there would be certain times of the day, certain times of the year, it would be more reliable. There are certain places in the earth that it seems to happen more often. Maybe these are like plate shifts is one of my thoughts. It's like energy vortexes, you know, however you want to look at that. If you want to go into this Einstein theory of black holes or singularities, but usually it will be some place or places, like look at the Bermuda Triangle, you know, the place where I lived on Mount Hood, there was a lot of it in Oregon. You know, there are certain places that you just seem to have a convergence where you're seeing moments in the past or maybe moments in the future. you know, and it's like, wow, why in these places, you know? So I think that there are energy grids or vortexes here and there, portals, where it happens more often than not. It happens later in the day, like near dusk, late afternoon. It happens in the early fall a lot, I've noticed.
Do we know, and I feel embarrassed for asking this because I feel like I've heard the answer and I know it and I just can't grasp it right now, but do we know if the brain works in a different way at night? Alpha, beta, theta, zeta, whatever. Is it in a different level? Not when we're sleeping necessarily, but just in the evening, that might make us more perceptible to strange phenomena.
You know, I think you're onto something there, and I don't think there's been much discussion on this, but I think you've really hit on something, because we probably start shutting down toward kind of a delta brain pattern, and we're shifting, you know, or maybe we go on heightened alert, you know, as it gets, you know, at that time of day, the primitive in us, you know, it's dusk, and we go into a rapid beta, you know, and rapid beta and delta aren't that far apart, really. So, I mean, maybe there is a shift in our consciousness that's brought about by the time of day in terms of our brain waves. But I think more often it's a matter of shutting down your physical brain and tuning into your higher consciousness. I think that we have to introduce the concept here that our consciousness operates outside of our physical brain. So I know that people like to think that the brain runs everything. Well, the brain runs your body. It is the engine that runs your body.
Right.
But we're more than that. We're hybrids, aren't we? We're hybrid beings. We're energy beings encapsulated in a physical body. So yeah. So, you know, like when you're sleeping, you know, the brain kind of slows down, doesn't it? Kind of shuts down a little bit. And we kind of roam in our dreams. So I introduce the concept, too, in this book, that when we're going into lucid dreaming, particularly, and they're very vivid and very real and meaningful dreams, you know, that you're actually seeming to go somewhere in the past, the future, or far, far away traveling in your dreams, and they seem so real, you know, and you wake up with a start, you know, it's just that your consciousness has kicked in and it's taken you there. Your consciousness can take you anywhere. Your consciousness, of course, is faster than the speed of light, you know. So yes, back to the Einstein theory of time travel, if you can travel at the speed of light, you could actually, you know, move in time. But physically, how can you? Physically, you would burn up. You would burn up, you know. Let's be real about this, you know.
Right.
So. But your consciousness can travel at the speed of light. This is what's happening in your lucid dreaming. Your consciousness, you know, you're going in a consciousness body. Your consciousness exists outside of your physical mind, your brain, you know. Mm-hmm. It resides on all levels of your being, all your subtle energy bodies. And inside and outside, you know, and consciousness is everything. It from the greatest galaxy to the smallest atom in all life forms in between, us included, we're all consciousness beings. So I say that what happens is you have a shift in consciousness, and it's not a shift in your brain pattern so much as allowing your brain to slow down or stop. And then your consciousness kicks in. It's called raising consciousness, or raised consciousness, or higher consciousness. In the yoga tradition, the samadhi mystics that shift in and out of time all the time for great insightful traveling, that's what they do. You know, they put themselves physically to sleep. They put their minds to sleep. And then the consciousness kicks in and takes them somewhere. And they actually plan this out. They actually will have a game plan, you know, a map where they want to go, what they want to see. Now, this is not a new concept, you know, not even since, you know, the start of the yoga tradition in India, in the East. Well, you know, the ancients, going back 2,000 years or more, in Egypt would have these dream temples, and they would induce their dreams to leave their body and go forward and backward in time to explore and learn.
That's, you know, I did a couple of different shows over the years where I actually had somebody kind of walk me through some of these patterns of almost like mind yoga, remote viewing in a sense, where you could actually revisit points in your history. And I'm doing a talk on this at the Michigan Paracon coming up on, I think, on ways to heal yourself through these modalities. And it's interesting to hear this play out. I want to revisit one quick topic, and then I'd like to hear some of the strange time slip phenomena, some of the stories that you've collected for the book. But I, you know what I'm curious about, Vaughn, is because people have more paranormal encounters at night, we've always attributed it to, well, it's quieter. You don't hear the dogs barking and the lawnmowers going and traffic. So your mind, there's a lot less distraction. But I'm wondering, truly, solar flares, we know, and the sun, the radiation from that can actually interrupt transmissions in broadcast signals, radio frequencies, cell phone towers. Could it be that it dampens our abilities during the day, and then as we're farther away from the sun, we've got the lunar transition, the magnetic pole changes, does that possibly open up a different way of experiencing things? So at night, we're not getting as much solar radiation interference, and we might be able to become more attuned to these situations.
Yeah, I think there's no accident that it happens at dusk and dawn. We have our profound insights, and going back to like lucid dreaming, you know, or if you want to talk about daydreaming, you know. So, I mean, I think that a lot of people, when they daydream they're actually time slipping, and you think, oh my gosh, where was I? Well, sometimes you're in your memory, you know, your physical memory in this lifetime, in this body. And that is like a brain stored memory. But if you're going someplace that you have no memory in this life of having been, and seeing people where you don't know them in this lifetime, if they're outside of your physical memory, then yes. So at dusk and dawn, and I think, you know, it's all electromagnetic energy. When we talk about consciousness, you know, I'm not talking about some way out there yoga idea of mysticism.
Right.
I'm talking about electromagnetic energy. I'm talking about Michael Faraday and James Maxwell and Einstein. I mean, I'm talking about electromagnetic radiation theory.
I like it. It's fascinating to me, and it's something I think we have to be more aware of. I wonder, I'm going to have to do some more deeper research, unless, of course, you've already done this for one of your books. When remote viewers are at their peak, I wonder if they are more adept at tapping in at those points, you know, dusk or dawn, you know, during moments when there's less transmissions, less interference. I wonder if that would be a place that would allow them into these places a little better.
Yeah, Dave, I think you're onto something. And you know, I mean, this is good research. You know, there's so much of this is hard to research. I mean, I always, you know, like in this book I talk about, this is anecdotal information, but we're looking for a pattern. You know, there's not a lot of serious scientific research. But here's a case where you could actually do research, you see. You could actually compile information on people that do remote viewing. You know, these are very reliable test subjects, you see, because they're very good at slipping in and slipping out. So when do they find it most accessible? When is it more difficult for them? There may be a time of day based on solar flare interference.
Yeah, boy, that would be, and Tim, I've got to guess, if we're also talking about this, you know a lot about RF, UHF, VHF, all the different frequencies that are bombarding our planet at all times. Nighttime has got to be one of the lesser time for all that broadcast interference to be taking place as well.
It is a time of lesser interference, but then frequencies carry further at night. So for a good example is with, like, say, AM radio. At night, you get, and I'm not talking Clear Channel, the company, but a Clear Channel AM signal. Like here in town with Minneapolis, you have WCCO radio, and their signal carries further. Or you have, like, say, KMOX in St. Louis, their signal carries further. I think it's is it WGN in Chicago? Is the
7:20 a.m. Yep. Yeah, you can hear it in Alabama at night. You can hear a lot of those stations, right?
And the reason being is that not only do more frequencies power down at night, but this network was built way back before World War II of stations to span across the nation to be an emergency network that would connect at night so that you could hear all over the nation these an emergency system should there be anything that would happen domestically. But it was made with the purpose that, you know, one station could connect with another that could connect with another and could cross state borders, with the idea that at night that signal would travel further because, of course, you would have less interference and that the signal could carry further with less impedance.
A lot of cool stuff to consider. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. Von Brashler, our guest today. Time shifts, experiences of slipping into the past and future. We'll hear some of those stories when we return to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is Darkness Radio. Remember to watch our live video stream tonight. You can find it on Darkness Radio YouTube channel. You can find it on our social media pages. We will be going live at 9 p.m. Central. That's 10 p.m. Eastern for those of you in the Pacific time frame, 7 p.m., 8 p.m. Mountain time. You know, I actually got yelled at online about that, Tim. How come I include Eastern, Central, and Pacific, but not Mountain time? I just figured if people in Mountain time know where they're sitting in between Pacific and Central, but I guess I've been remiss and I've become a Mountain Time racist is how this person posted it. So
you become a mountainist, Dave. Yeah.
Is that what it is? A mountainist? I'm against them. Yep. Whatever it is, I'm against it. All right. Von Brashler, our guest, Time Shifts, Experiences of Slipping into the Past and Future is the book. It's out and available right now. We have link up for the book on our website and on our post for today's program, so it's very easy for you to find. All right, Von, so let's get into some of the stories that really captured your imagination, some of the time slip phenomena that you found the most credible and interesting.
Well, I think that Rudolf Fence was a good one. Rudolf Fence was a man who in 1950 was dodging cars in New York. And he acted as though he'd never seen a car before. And people who witnessed Rudolf Fence, well, they didn't know who he was at the time. He was a man dressed in a top hat, a very out-of-date suit, handlebar mustache. And, people noticed that he was caught in traffic, and he was frightened and confused by the cars. And he was struck by a car. And he was killed. And they took his body to the morgue, and they tried to figure out, you know, what the heck, what this man was all about. And they went through his pockets, and they found a livery bill from a livery stable in Philadelphia, an ancient document. They found other documents on him that were very old. They found strange coins, old coins, some they never couldn't even recognize. And they found a business card. And the business card said, Dr. Rudolf Fence. Now, there was no phone number, and they wondered, you know, and no address. It said, Dr. Rudolf Fence. So they wondered if he'd been given that card by a doctor or if he was that doctor. And they tried to figure out who he was, and so they checked the missing persons. There was no such report of a missing person. After several days, they were very concerned. So there was a police investigation, of course, tried to find out, you know, this John Doe that was hit by a car. and they looked through the phone book. They had phone books in 1950, folks, and they looked through the phone book, and they found Mrs. Rudolph Fence was listed. They went to her house, the police, and she said, they asked her if you were a widow. She said, yes, I'm a widow. Were you married to a man called Dr. Rudolph Fence? She said, no. Now, my husband, bless his soul, was named Rudolph Fence, Jr. His father, according to my husband, was a doctor. And it was a strange story my husband told. One day, when he was very young boy, his father, Dr. Fence, went out for a stroll, and he never came back. So
yes,
that story has been poo-pooed for years, probably because it was first written in Collier's Magazine of September 15, 1951, by Jack Finney. And because he didn't think apparently people would accept this as like a real story, a legitimate story, he wrote it up like some crazy account, like almost fiction. But through the years, people have really begun to wonder who was Dr. Rudolph Fence. Now, that's one of my favorite stories. There's the story of...
Well, if I could stop you really quickly, that's fascinating to me. I've often wondered if we were to examine now with 21st century information, if we were to examine people that were hospitalized, institutionalized as being crazy, who claimed to have appeared out of nowhere, and there have been these cases, could we track them to different eras in time where, you know, all of a sudden you've got this guy who's here, like you said, dodging cars and, you know, struck and killed. And, you know, 150 years earlier, he vanished on a walk. Could there be something to this? And people often think of time and paranormal ghosts, things like that, as it all has to come from our past, but forgetting that the future is at play as well. And if we can reach these concepts, we might be seeing future visitors that are stranded here accidentally or past visitors. It's an interesting concept. As a matter of fact, to get sci-fi nerdy on you, one of my favorite aspects of the Doctor Who series is a villain they call the Weeping Angels, who, when they touch you, they send you back into time somewhere. And then however many years you were going to live in this time era, they absorb that for their own life. So it's really kind of a fascinating deal, but it basically displaces you. You don't die, but you might as well be, because you're thrown out of your own timeline and put somewhere else. So it's an interesting concept. And I've thought often, if there's places like, you know, and a lot of these vanishings happen in national parks, which you've got to realize is undiluted geomagnetic principles, right? Have their own forces that are not affected by what man has built yet. So could there be these portals where people have wandered in and out? I wonder if they started researching, could they find people that were found wandering in the woods in the past? Or, you know, if we go forward in the future, if people have suddenly appeared or bodies have appeared that they can't figure out, could it be from the future, these people popping in and getting lost? I don't know. That it's a heady concept, but man, I think there's something to that. And I wish there was a way to have TV CSI, right, where you type in a few things and take a fingerprint, and all of a sudden you've got the information you need. Unfortunately, that doesn't truly exist. But once we get to that point, like they're doing now with genetics and DNA through genealogy websites, I wouldn't be surprised to find that we could connect these people.
Yeah, I thought of that too. You know, people that go missing in parks all the time. It happens all the time. There's, you know, it could be multiple reasons. But then we think of like Bigfoot. You talked about Bigfoot. So, you know, we know that there were giant hairy apes in the past. Maybe we're just like converging time in our time points on the timeline. But you know, people do actually peer from the future, and they'll pop in and out. There was a strange story of the Charlie Chaplin opening in 1928. Can we talk about that?
In yeah, I'd love to. Please, go ahead.
1928, this is the debut of a Charlie Chaplin film. And this is really big stuff, you know. This is a Hollywood extravaganza. The movie was Circus. So in 1928, people are lined up waiting to get in. You know, this was the biggest thing going. So, but there were many witnesses to a woman who was walking back and forth in front of the theater. And she seemed oddly dressed, and she seemed nervous, and she a bit agitated. And she was trying to speak into something that she held up to her ear. Now, we might think this would be a common thing on a street today if somebody had a cell phone, but we're talking about 1928. So they noticed that she was talking into it, but she seemed to have trouble as though she couldn't, you know, no one was talking to her. It was like a one-way communication, and she was trying to shout into it, you know, like nobody could hear her. And then suddenly she disappeared. Now, there were many, many witnesses to this. There were newspaper write-ups about the strange lady that they all saw, you know, and now...
Right, there's actual footage that exists from this, right? It's special footage that appeared in the DVD mix, yep.
So I'm suggesting to you that maybe she was from the future speaking into a cell phone in 1928. Who in the world would she be talking to? She was not getting very good reception.
Right. Well, there's no cell towers again. So right. Again, we're thinking that perspective. It very well could be those early Motorola phones that worked more like a walkie-talkie. So if somebody else was there stationed with the same equipment, their transmissions might have been able to be communicated back and forth.
Yeah. So I love these stories of time slips. Let's call them accidental time slips, where people take one step and boom, they're momentarily somewhere in the past or the future, and then boom, they're back. And they're terribly disoriented. And it happens to everyday people. It happens to famous people. It happens to very credible people, like the two ladies from Oxford University that went to Versailles. And my goodness, in 1901, they go to Versailles and they see Marie Antoinette. Well, that can't possibly be. And so they report on this. And then so researchers go and they say, well, you seem to see things that weren't even there in 1901. And then they research and they found, actually, in the past, there was a bridge these ladies walked across. There really were garden parties where people were costumed. You know, Marie Antoinette did go into her small garden in Versailles, the Petit Trianon, and she would sit at an easel and sketch. And these were regular happenings. There was a little bridge at that time that they could walk across that no longer existed in 1901. And so you get something like credible, like the British Psychic Research Society, and they would actually look into these things and try to figure out how credible they were. You know, so there's some credibility to some of these stories when you have university professors and formal research done. Then you have maps and you have history on your side, and what they could not have known in 1901 actually was verified later as actually happening at a very earlier time.
You know, it makes me wonder. There was the book that came out, I want to say it was like 10 years. Tim, we just talked about this recently, and if you remember it better, please remind me, or maybe you can Google it while we're chatting so we can remind people what the book is called. But this gentleman wrote a book about a ship that was called the Titan that strikes a... it was the unsinkable ship. It had, you know, three smokestacks. This guy described Titanic and that it sunk and how everything went down. But he wrote it 10 years prior to, I think it was like 10 years prior to the sinking of the Titanic. And the fact that he named the ship the Titan and all of these similarities, it makes you wonder, you know, was this in a form, was he picking up on a future broadcast, kind of a concept that was out there, and why so many people will have ideas? simultaneously. And how many of us have sat at home going, oh God, I can't believe they invented that. I thought of that 10 years ago. Well, maybe there was a download of information. Many of you got that 10 years ago, but one of you put it into action. Von Braschler put pen to paper and wrote the book, as opposed to just, oh man, I thought of a book just like this. And this is, I wrote down some notes. They match his stuff because it was always there. It's part of this, you know, this ethereal plane, whether you want to call it the Akashic Records or whatever, that it exists. And whoever acts upon it first is the one that cashes in. The early bird gets the worm, so to say.
Yeah, all these conscious thoughts that are out there, you know, go back to Jung's concept of the universal unconscious. These are all floating about. It's like old radio waves that never die. They're faintly out there. Every thought that's ever been thought, every bit of music that's ever been hummed or imagined, it's out there. And if you can tap into it, you know, this goes into the mystics. You know, they can tap into it. They can get into a conscious state, an altered state of heightened consciousness, and they can reach out there and grab it. You know, was it the lady who wrote the book about all the great musicians that tap into this, what she called the fourth dimension, often called time. And they say she, you know, Helene Kareen was her name. Helene Kareen wrote about the musicians, the great composers like Mozart, that could just reach out there and hear the music. They could hear it in their heads. You know, they're not creating it so much as writing it down like dictation.
Right. They've become the transcriber for these messages that are coming through. Those are some really freaky. Were there any cases that once you wrote this book came to your attention that you wish you would have included in the book?
Well, yeah, Helene Kareen always comes to mind. But, you know, like inventors, you know, many people will have the same thought at once. You know, it's often said that many people will have the same idea for music at once, or they'll have the same idea, you know, for something new, some new invention or concept. They'll have it at once. And so I think there's just a whole lot we could do, you know, and of course, I'm bombarded by people who say, are these alien encounters, are they actually from our past or future? You know, very likely, you know. I think that everything that is has been, you know. I mean, the past is still operating. If you look at time as being a huge conveyor belt or a loop that goes around and around, the past is still happening. I mean, right. If you lost someone in the past, they're still there, you know. That past is still there. The future, we haven't caught up with it yet because our perception is not focused on that point in time and space, but it's already there waiting for us. So, yeah, I think these things are, like, happening. So it's very possible to me that somebody from the future could come back and look in on us. Mm-hmm. You know, they're probably not to, like, change us or anything, not that they could, but they're looking in on us. They're probably bringing insights, just as the shamans historically would go back into the past to listen to the ancestors, what they had to say, and they'd report what they heard, you know.
Right.
And this very likely could be us looking back. Maybe we look like that in the future, you know. And if all life is interrelated and interdependent, maybe even if they're from another planet, they could be us in the future living on another planet. That's what I think.
What Tim dug it up for me. Thank you, Tim. I appreciate that. This even goes back further. The original novella was called Futility, and it was written by Morgan Robertson and published as Futility in the year 1898. It was then revised as The Wreck of the Titan in 1912. And it features a fictional British ocean liner, Titan, that sinks in the North Atlantic after striking an iceberg. Titan is now famous for the similarities to the passenger ship, the Titanic, which sank 14 years later after the revised version, The Wreck of the Titan, came out. So I'll tell you what, Tim sent me a link for the book. I'm going to put that on today's show as well so you guys can find it. It's fascinating. And if you're a fan of Titanic, you might want to go check this book out for yourself. You know, Von, one of the aspects of the of ghosts that I've found intriguing, and Tim and I, when we visited Waverly Hills, was the fact that there were sightings of these ghost nurses and doctors that had been seen from time to time. They would like round the corner, they would look up and see you and then turn around and run. And I always thought, well, that's not how it happens in Casper, right? I mean, ghosts aren't afraid of us. We're afraid of them. But when you talk to the people and look at the research, there was reportings of hauntings during the time Waverly Hills was an active hospital. Well, we attribute it to the amount of people, tens of thousands of tuberculosis patients that went through there that died. Then it was an old folks home where there was quite a bit of death. So we assume, well, of course it's going to be haunted. It's got these connections to all this death. But what if the ghosts that these employees were seeing were not in fact dead people? It was time slip phenomena. They rounded the corner and there's Dave and Tim, the Beavis and Butthead of the paranormal, standing there in their Metallica and Megadeth t-shirts. And they round the corner and see us in totally strange apparel, holding weird technology that they run off and run and hide. You know, are we haunting ourselves?
I encourage people to tread carefully when they go ghost hunting, because you're disturbing people. You really are. You know, they can see, if you can see them, they can see you. You know, and so you know it's like we're seeing them at a moment in their time that converges with our moment in this time, and if for one moment we're at the same point crossing on the same time loop. And if you notice that, you'll very often, people will say of ghost hauntings, they'll say, you know, this is what they did. You know, it happens over and over and over and over. Like, this is the moment that gets like crossed over. This is the little bump in the vinyl record that keeps skipping. Right. This is where it happens at the same point on the record. You know. So I think, I think that I've had this experience when I was up on Mount Hood, and I was walking in the woods, and I was talking to my neighbors recently about how we'd often see just at dusk, you know, on a late summer, early fall night, we'd see pioneers from the Barlow Trail, and they'd be resting against their Conestoga wagons, and they look so gaunt and tired and dirty and ragged, and so thirsty, and they just collapse. And we had the same vision. We would not see it, you know, be standing side by side, but independently we'd see the same thing over and over and over, you know. And they would not see us because they were. But here's the case. I'm walking through the woods up there, and I'm thinking about how the Native Americans from the Warm Spring tribe up the top of the mountain used to gather in exactly where I was located, a place we called Bright Woods, because the natives from Warm Springs called it Bright Woods. They would gather in there in the summer for a sort of summer retreat. It was a tradition, and they would gather there, and it was very important to them. While I'm walking along thinking about this, and boom, this tall Native American in a beautiful costume, red with yellow and brown and black trim, and wearing feathers, very colorful individual, pops in front of me, and I almost bump into him, and I'm startled, and he's startled because he sees me, and I shout, and he goes, oh, he starts to open his mouth, and then he disappears. I startled him. You know, yes, he was a spirit walker. He was probably a shaman, and boom, he's returning, you know, to the summer grounds where his ancestors used to gather, you know. And it's like, ooh, I startled him, and I felt bad that I shouted at him, because hey, he's just traveling through time, and I'm just doing the same thing, you know.
That must have been crazy, and I wonder what the shamans think of that. Are they? tapped in enough that they realize what it is they're experiencing, or is it as, you know, is it as strange to them, or do they have a working concept of what it is that they're bumping into?
I think they report as best they can what they've seen. In this case, he probably reported back that he went into the future and the woods were filled with white men who were wearing strange clothes and walking around. And he's saying, you know, the forest looks the same, but there are white people who live there now. And they probably pondered this, what lies ahead for them. Was the land would not change, but there would be these new people living there wearing these strange clothes.
You know, it makes you wonder if people have had this ability to do these things, why wouldn't they adjust and see what was coming down the pike? Why wouldn't they take up arms or move away to find someplace safer at those moments? That's been the one question I have about the shaman dreamwalkers and people that claim to be able to remote view and see these things and claim that it's always been a part of who we are.
Well, I think that it's outside of our frame of reference to a point where we have trouble internalizing the message. It just doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit. You say, well, it's very strange. I don't know what to think of it. It just, it doesn't fit anything in our known, you know, moving reality. So we can't say, well, I understand exactly what to do now. You know, it's like you see what lies ahead, but you really can't react to it until you get there.
All right. When we talk and you talk about the fact that you put together some steps for people that want to start to experience these type of things, are there a few, and obviously we don't want to give away the whole shooting match here on the show, but are there a few steps that they can start right now and then they can pick up your book and go even further with?
Yeah. I mean, the first one I list, and people who are familiar with yoga might have heard of this one. This is like Carlos Castaneda, stopping time, stop the world. So you sit down and you're looking at a clock or a watch or something with a, ideally with a second hand, sweeping second hand on it. You could do it with something digital too. You try to make it so that the clock stops. So traditionally this exercise is you focus your intent, your conscious intent on the second hand so it doesn't move. Now, if you're working with something without a second hand, a more modern watch or clock, then you try to make it so that the minute hand does not advance to the next minute. And you try to stop it. You try to stop it. This is not stopping the world so much as stopping your perception of the world. So you're altering your consciousness. You're actually accelerating your consciousness to where you're sitting there. Now, you have to do this. You have to get into a almost a meditative point of standing. You have to be seated or with your feet firmly on the ground. I say take your shoes off. Let your feet make contact with the ground. You reach a still point deep within you. You try to tune out your distractions so you're no longer hearing, seeing, or sensing anything outside you or inside you, no thoughts traveling through you. You just slow it all down until all you're looking at is this clock. And you say, you focus your intention on it. Now, the old literature says concentrate. And I say, no, don't concentrate. That's an exercise of the physical brain. I say, focus. Focus your intent on stopping that clock from advancing. See how long, practice how long you can do it. This is an exercise in reaching a state of heightened consciousness, or if you will, awareness, where you're actually beginning to control time around you. Now, if you can stop that second hand from advancing even a few seconds, you're getting there. And you keep practicing. See if you can stop it for a whole minute. Just a whole minute. You see, you can't actually learn to control time around you. Your perception of time, your conscious awareness of time, no one else's. That's the first step into becoming a bit. And then as you do this more and more, I have to add there are really good side benefits other than moving in and out of time. You can learn to stretch time. You can learn to actually condense time. I mean, since I've started this practice, I've actually learned there are times when I have very little, very, very little clicks on the clock to get something done, and I can just stretch it and stretch it and stretch it and stretch it. I mean, I've done things that should have taken me 16 hours and in like an hour and 60 minutes. You know, it's like, I don't know exactly what the conversion table is, but you can learn to stretch or condense time.
That's something I'm definitely interested in more. Obviously, the older we get, we want to learn more of a command of time. Because, again, time being kind of a construct that we have created, are we yielding to it too often? Should we be more aware of it and in the moment? How do we get that aspect back? On a daily basis, I sit here in marvel at just how quickly I have become a bitch to time as opposed to making time my bitch, right? I mean, I'm going to be 54 this year, and it feels like I was just in college 5-10 years ago. Tim and I had just met, and here we are 15 years long into Darkness Radio. It's just a strange concept to me that time seems controllable in some elements and not in others. And is it because of our commitment to being in that time, or is it because time has no master?
Time has no master, I guess. I mean, but we can become a master of change in our own lives by actually becoming a master of time and space. It sounds like a grand plan. But every great adventure starts with a first step, and I think that you can learn to control time a bit, and if you can learn to actually slow it all down, the time that you're experiencing, then you could actually move forward or backward in time, you know. But I mean, you have to consciously do this; otherwise, it's accidental, and it's what we call a time slip. We all have these time slips. It's like, oh my gosh, where was I? I can't account for it all this time. Where was I? You know, the world seemed different, you know, that, you know, and so these are like disorienting. You know, most people will slip in and out of time accidentally. Those of us who will, you know, seem conscious of it will say, oh, it was accidental. And then you wonder how you get it back again. Well, you get it back again by reaching this deep still point, you know, within you, where you allow, you know, you yourself to reach this altered state of consciousness. You have to let this, your perception of the world around you, just kind of dissolve until all, you know, it goes dark. And then this higher consciousness kicks in. So, I mean, I do have these exercises to get to that point, and I've borrowed heavily from yoga masters that have done this, like the Samadhi mystics claim that they can teach their young chelas from an early age to reach this point, but they do it gradually. They start by learning to control their dreams. They have lucid dreaming. And they get very good at this, you know, as they progress, as they develop this familiarity. This is developing an acute awareness in an altered state of consciousness.
I wonder if in doing so, when we have these moments of deja vu, do you believe that that is also a kind of a minimalistic version of a time slip phenomena, or is that something broader, a different aspect altogether?
Well, I do. I do believe in the deja vu as being a time shift. And I actually have a chapter in the book about deja vu, funny you'd mention. But I think that there are moments when a lot of us will say, oh, my gosh, one of two things. I've met this person before, and I can't figure out when. And you try to figure it out. We all play this game. Where were you born? Where did you take a vacation? Where did you go to school? Have I ever seen you on the news? Were you ever in a magazine? And there's just nothing either one of you can come up with. So where did you meet this person? Not on this ordinary reality, this time-space that we now occupy, not at this point. So then there's also the deja vu where you walk into a room and you say, oh my gosh, I've been here before. And you try to figure out where. Did I read about it? Did I see it in a book? Did I see it in a magazine? Was it in a film? Was it a documentary? You know, where did it happen? Was I here as a child? No, you know, and it's like, oh my gosh. And maybe this is a place where you've actually seen in a lucid dream. You see, when we actually do have the ability to time shift. Because in your dreams, you know, you can go anywhere in time and space you want.
Right.
I mean, your consciousness is that good. You know, it's not limited by your physical perception. It's not limited by the three-dimensional world we occupy. It is not limited by our perception of time and space. It is limitless. So then there's also the deja vu where you've experienced either, well, we say this person or this place or this time. And you say, like, oh my gosh, I've been here before, but it was a different time of year. And it's like, where on earth could this have happened, you know? So I think we do shift. I do think we do shift. Sometimes we'll have these deja vu moments when we say, oh my gosh, I must have actually experienced this in another time and place other than my physical memory of having done so in this lifetime. So if it's not in your memory bank, where is it? So I submit to you that there is your memory bank in your brain, and then there's the memory bank of your inner spirit, your consciousness, your soul, whatever you want to call it, your eternal life force. And your consciousness, your higher consciousness, knows everywhere you've been. It knows everywhere you're going. It knows everything. You know, it is much smarter than your physical brain. So this is what the mystics have always tried to tap into. This is your supercomputer.
I read something. It was like Disturbing Notions, but it had me thinking a little bit, especially about this interview coming up with you. You know, we've all had that phenomena where we've heard our voice called out, but yet there's no one there. And it was really kind of a trippy statement, but it said, what if all those times you heard your voice being called out and there's nobody there? It's because your consciousness and subconsciousness are equally aware at that moment, and you're in a life review in a coma, and somebody's calling out to you from the other side, from the living, trying to bring you back. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because does that fit into this time slip phenomena as well? How would we know? You know, they talk about living in the matrix, living in this three-dimensional computer-generated simulation, and that we wouldn't really know. We would have a certain level of consciousness, which is what we all experience, but if we look, we can see some of these hiccups, some of these time disturbances, which we might refer to as a Mandela effect or time slip phenomena, right? And have these instances take place. I'm really intrigued by these aspects and the fact that, you know, what are we doing? Where are we in our own timelines? Are we truly present here in the moment, or are we simply reviewing the past? Has it already played out? And these memories that we have now are nothing more than the moments we've lived already.
I don't think these are alternate possibilities. I think they're all related. All of this is related. And I have a future book coming out, I think this fall. It's called Mysterious Messages from Beyond, where I actually look at this. You know, someone calls out your name and you hear, you'll be walking in the woods and you'll hear somebody calling. You'll hear somebody calling out numbers, or you're calling out your name. And it's like, where is this coming from? And so then I've had this experience. I'm waking up in the morning and I'm hearing like, oh, someone's calling me. And then they're telling me something. And it's as clear as could be, but it's inside my head. And I'm saying, did you hear that? Did you hear that? It was clear as could be. No, I didn't hear that. Say, wait, I'm hearing voices. Yes, you are. You know, because there is this connection we always have. And I think we're very often slipping in and out of other time realities. And back to the multi-universe theory. I think that very often we're living in two timelines, or we're living multiple lives, and you're constantly shifting back and forth, back and forth. So, I mean, really, are we? I think, you know, we're sleepers who need to awaken to a greater reality. You know, you remember the great scene in the book and movie Dune, where the young master, you know, the son of the Duke, Paul Atreides, he says the sleeper has awakened. This is what Krishnamurti, this is what so many people, Gurdjieff said we need to do, is awaken. We're sleeping. We're not fully conscious. You see. So all I'm saying here is there's a higher consciousness that people need to be aware of. When you're aware of this level of consciousness, you'll realize that we're occupying just one little bit of space and reality. There's so much more. It's like we're bobbing on this big iceberg in the middle of
right.
a vast ocean.
Right.
And there's this huge iceberg below us. We have no idea how deep it goes. We can't see the top of the iceberg from where we stand. Where we sit on the iceberg, afraid to move, mm-hmm. we cannot really understand what's on the other side of the iceberg. This is our reality. It's so narrow.
Do you think in dream, do you think that that is truly just the mind unwinding? Is it, you know, our brain trying to process the data that we've taken in that day, and that's why it seems fragmented and disjointed? Or do you think that we are, in effect, time traveling, lucid dreaming being a form of controlling the elements of where you're going and what you're doing, astral projection, out of body, near death, if you want, in a sense. They say sleep is as close to death, right? I mean, are we in those throes in those moments?
Yes, I think that in a lucid dream, you know, that's very clear and instructive and insightful, that in fact we have time traveled. I think that we have that ability to leave the body in a consciousness body, in an energy body, and go somewhere. Now, a lot of people have other kinds of dreams. These are like fitful, restless dreams we have. And this is where the brain, the physical brain, is wrestling with concepts and problems and concerns that we were not able to resolve during the day, but we can't quite forget. And the brain is working overtime. It's working during your sleep, when you should be resting. And the brain is not resting. It's trying to resolve these questions, which it couldn't resolve when it was fully illuminated. And now it's in this drowsy sleep state, and it's trying to, well, these are fitful dreams. These are ordinary dreams. They're typical dreams. that we have during normal sleep cycles. And most of the dream research has unfortunately focused on this and not lucid dreaming. It's focused on the period when your eyes are fluttering, rapid eye movement, and we have nightmares. And these are like troublesome dreams. And in the tip-off that these are ordinary dreams of the brain, of the memory, of the unresolved questions in our mind, is that we're trying to resolve concerns of our normal waking lives. Now, the dreams where you go outside yourself and you travel to exotic locations and exotic times, and you come back with insightful memories, clear. These are something else. These are lucid dreams. These are, in fact, the conscious body leaving the physical body, much as in near-death experiments, you know. And I mean, you think of Dr. A. Moody and how he started looking at this, and then he ended up realizing that there was a whole lot more to this than simply what he was looking at, which was how we have these near-death experiences. He ended up believing in timelines, really, you know, a past and a future that lies ahead of us. And I think that we actually do travel in these lucid dreams. And so I also have in the book exercises you can explore lucid dreaming to set up, to actually program a lucid dream. And you can do this actually in, like we would say, like a waking dream, a daydream, you know, or you can actually program before you go to sleep that you're going to have a specific dream. You know, you set it up. You know, every good adventure, every good travel, you know, you pack for it, you know, you prepare for it. You have yourself a roadmap. You have an intent of where you want to go and what you want to see. And so it is with our dreams. When we travel in our dreams, you can actually program a lucid dream.
I like that. And again, you've got a lot packed in this book. Great stories, tips and hints on how to expand your horizons to experience more. Vaughn, it's always a pleasure catching up with you. And you got to let us know when the new book comes out this fall. We'd love to have you back with us. It's been too long.
Yeah. I have one coming out in July called Manifesting. And then I think November is the Mysterious Messages from Beyond. And they're kind of related.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to talking to you a few more times this year then. And we've got links up so people can find you, find your books, and keep in touch. Thank you so much for joining us and spending a little time here with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. All right. That's it for today, folks. Remember, tonight, watch the live video stream on Darkness Radio YouTube channel or on the Darkness Radio and Dave Schrader social media pages. You'll be able to watch tonight's Holzer's Ghosts as we examine the Lambert Castle episode, season one, I think episodes 5 or 6. And it's a fascinating case. Lots going on and a lot to do with what we discussed today. So I hope you check that out. We'll be back again tomorrow with the podcast version of that show, and we'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, that's Tim Dennis, and this is Darkness Radio.